Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moscowane. Matt Gross has visited at least 60 countries all over the world. He's traveled on tight budgets, gotten lost, found new friends, experienced grave illness and crushing loneliness. And along the way, he's eaten local delicacies like lamb's head, grasshoppers, or horse meat sashimi. He takes readers along for a wild ride in his new book, The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World. And he joins us today to tell us about his adventures here on Radio Times. Matt Gross, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
And if you have a question, I've already gotten some questions on Twitter, Matt, but if you have a question that you want to phone in, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. If you're a traveler yourself or are planning to go somewhere, chances are Matt has been there already. So, Matt, you were 22 when you did your first serious trip abroad, and you chose Vietnam. Why did you want to go there?
Well, there's two reasons. One is I like the food.
Okay.
I had eaten at a bunch of Vietnamese restaurants in the States, and I was finishing college, and I figured I should go somewhere where I really like the food. So that was Vietnam. That seemed like a good enough reason. The other, you know, I can also be, you know, philosophical about it. I can say that growing up as a child of the 80s and being sort of surrounded by Vietnam-related pop culture, movies like Platoon and Full Metal Jacket, and hearing about the Vietnam era from my parents, I really wanted to go and see what this country was all about.
And
but
what was
I wanted to eat a lot of Vietnamese food.
Okay, good plan. What was your degree in?
In creative writing. I went to Johns Hopkins University. I studied, you know, how to write short stories. I was planning to be a great novelist.
Is that what you were going to do in Vietnam, or what were you going to do for a living?
Yeah, I had all these fantasies about what my life would be like in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, the former Saigon. I was going to write great novels. I was going to do some kind of work. I wasn't exactly sure what. I was going to learn Vietnamese very quickly and sort of integrate myself into Vietnamese society. Those things didn't quite happen the way I expected.
But you definitely had, I guess, we don't want to call it a travel bug, but you had an adventurous streak to want to do that, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I've just always been a very curious person. I grew up in a family that liked to travel and moved around a bit, so I was just always very comfortable with exploring the world, whether it was driving around Virginia looking for great places to go skateboarding, or setting off at the age of 22 for Vietnam with no idea of what I was going to be doing when I got there. Just curious and sort of too dumb to realize that I might be getting myself into trouble.
So when you describe in the book that when you arrived, you had this kind of overwhelming feeling of closeness, everything was close, the traffic, and how did that affect you?
Oh, I mean, it was terrifying at first. The place is just dense. It's a big city, 7 million people, covered with these low, dense concrete buildings, people everywhere, motorbikes everywhere, life just going on in the streets everywhere. It was tough. I didn't know how to deal with it, except by sort of not dealing with it. One of the things I learned pretty quickly is that my ignorance of the world was a good protection. I didn't know how badly I was doing for a long time because I didn't know that I could be doing badly. I didn't know what things were supposed to be like.
What do you mean you were doing badly? What were you doing wrong?
Oh, I had a hard time learning Vietnamese. I had a hard time finding friends. I had a hard time finding work. Things were not living up to my fantasy life. And one of the toughest parts is that as much as I loved Vietnamese food, I had a hard time figuring out Vietnamese eating culture, knowing what to eat and when and why. I was always eating the wrong noodle soup at the wrong time of day, it seemed, or winding up in a really great restaurant that was utterly empty, and wondering where are the other people who should be eating this great grilled eel on sugarcane, or some, you know, fantastic fried crabs. I would be alone in these restaurants. It was very isolating and lonely for a while.
So what did you figure out? What were you doing wrong when it comes to eating?
I wasn't doing anything wrong exactly. I just hadn't found the one thing I could use to anchor my day. And I found it quite by accident. There are these little restaurants all over Vietnam whose name translates as the people's food. They're just little cheap places. They have a bunch of dishes that you get on rice. And I was walking by one that was serving these just beautiful grilled pork chops. They had the grill out front and just had this wonderful smell of pork and caramelizing fat and sugar and lemongrass just wafting out. And I said, okay, this is what I'm going to eat for lunch. And I ate there. It was very simple. You point at what you want, and they give it to you. And I started eating this every day and expanding across this one little place's menu. And I found that when I'd sort of lock down one meal a day, when I could like do lunch correctly, like every other Vietnamese person around, I could experiment at dinner. And I could not worry that for breakfast I was having coffee and a croissant. Having one thing to hold on to made every other experiment and failure that much easier to deal with.
And how did you did eventually find a job. What did you do?
Well, at first I was teaching English. It was a job that I had set up through a friend of a friend of a friend of my father's. It wasn't a very good English teaching job. And I got sort of tired of it. I was living in Saigon, and I heard that there was a film festival going on in Hanoi. So I quit my job, and I flew up to Hanoi, and I went to the offices of the Vietnam News, which is the state-run daily English-language newspaper. And I went to the editor-in-chief, and I said, hey, there's this film festival going on. Can I cover it for you? And Mr. Quyen, who is this wonderful, thin, mustachioed Vietnamese journalist who spoke very quietly and precisely in perfect English, looked at me and said, okay, our features page editor has just quit, so you can have her page. And so for the next 3 weeks, I had a page to myself in the national English language newspaper, writing film reviews and writing about what was going on at this film festival.
So I guess, is somewhat of a theme in your book too. I mean, luck has to be on your side as a traveler. I mean, I guess sometimes you get lucky and sometimes you don't, is one of the things in world travel, correct?
Yeah, luck. I mean, luck. I live on luck. Most travelers live on luck, and I've been very luck has worked out for me. I don't know how to control it. I don't know if I've been luckier than most people, but I find that taking risks helps. I put myself in positions where people want to help me. Maybe I just seem so helpless that people extend that hand of friendship and offer me jobs and food and a place to stay in some of the strangest corners of the world. But I think that's a thing that most people can do if they try. You just have to put yourself in those positions.
We're talking with travel writer Matt Gross. He has written The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World. You may also know him from the New York Times, where for several years he was the frugal traveler, and we'll get to how all that happened in a moment. Now, you mentioned a lot of very strange food in your book, and in the chapter or in the part about your first stint there in Vietnam, you did eat one of those half-hatched eggs, which is kind of a personal nightmare of mine. So describe. I know it's almost lunchtime, so be gentle, but describe that experience.
Oh, sure. So half-hatched egg is a duck egg that's been allowed, where its embryo has been allowed to develop for a couple of weeks. Usually in Vietnam, and I think in the Philippines as well, they eat these boiled. It's a sort of school kid's snack on the way to on the way to the bus. You know, eating a sort of semi-developed duck embryo. I'd heard of this, and in my first week in Vietnam, I was served this by the friend of a friend of a friend of my father's who helped me out with a job, except that it wasn't boiled. It was scrambled. So there was this little fetal duck sort of splayed out in a pool of scrambled egg, and I had to try and eat this thing. I don't really remember how it tasted. I remember it had a sort of cartilaginous texture, and there were little short black hairs all over it. It was a bit tough to get down, just because it was so outside of what I'd been used to and what I'd been expecting from Vietnamese cuisine.
Did you ever for a moment think, maybe I can decline Was there a moment when you said,
No, never. No, I was in someone's house and they're serving me this food. Of course I had to try and eat it. I mean, my parents brought me up that way.
All right. It's what I call the perils of a good upbringing.
Yeah,
that you
exactly.
can't say
but,
no.
You know, but it was, it meant a lot, I think, to my host that mm-hmm. I tried to eat it. This was not, this was a moment where I had a choice to make. I could, you know, turn it down and erect a barrier between myself and this family, or I could try. I didn't have to love everything, but I did my best, and I didn't comment on how strange it was. I just ate it as if it was something normal, which it was. This was something normal for the family, and that helped. That willingness to put aside my own, feelings of disgust or confusion went a long way. It's a good approach to travel that way. You need to be able to control your impulses. You need to say, this is strange, this is outside of my experience, but I'm going to think about it differently.
Yeah. And Matt, I'm not blaming the half-hatched duck egg here, but you did get sick in Vietnam. You had your first kind of bout of what affects many travelers. So what happened to you?
I within that first week in Vietnam, I got a bug called giardiasis, which is a common intestinal parasite carried usually in bad water, and it causes the symptoms you might expect. There's diarrhea, there's bloating, some abdominal cramping, fatigue, and loss of appetite, which for me was the worst part of it. being in Vietnam, a place where all I wanted to do was eat, and getting sick in a way that made me not want to eat at all was just torture. And I've had giardia in Vietnam, in India, in Mexico.
Is it chronic or recurring, or it comes back? You get a new infection each time, or does it stay within you?
You have to talk to my gastroenterologist.
Will do.
But I think I've just gotten reinfected again and again because I'm willing to kind of eat anything. It's really primarily carried in water. So this is one of these things where you should really just be washing your hands and drinking bottled water and being careful about where you brush your teeth. But I don't know. It's not the worst thing in the world to get this bug, especially once you learn how to deal with it. I mean, I've had it often enough now that when I feel the symptoms coming on, I recognize them and I know what kind of drugs to buy and how to get them from a pharmacy if there's not a doctor nearby. And I can deal with it in the span of 24 hours, and it doesn't sideline me the way it used to, and the way getting sick probably does for a lot of people. Getting sick is not fun when you're traveling, but once it happens, once you learn to deal with it, the next time it happens, it goes by much quicker.
All right, we have to take a short break, Matt. That is Matt Gross. He is a travel writer and has written The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World. We'll be right back. If you have a question for Matt or traveling or going somewhere, 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and kicks off its New Dreamers and Doers speaker series with shoe designer Stuart Weitzman and WHYY's innovations reporter Zach Seward, who will discuss the story of the Stuart Weitzman Company, an intergenerational tale of vision, entrepreneurship, and the American spirit. The event takes place at the museum on Wednesday, June 12th at 7 p.m. Program tickets at www.nmajh.org. Seating is limited.
You decide the winners at WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs, June 20th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Food fanatics will love this two-hour tasting, featuring an array of mouth-watering munchies served up by local restaurants and businesses, all competing to be named 2013's Best of the Chefs, with summer beer garden, specialty cocktails, and live music. WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs. Tickets at whyy.org/events.
Hi, I'm Mike McGrath, host of You Bet Your Garden, hoping you'll join us this Saturday morning at 11. We'll slay your slugs, we'll divert your deer, we'll try and help you face off those evil squirrels, and we'll do it all organically. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Matt Gross. His new book is The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World. You might remember Matt from his stint with the New York Times, where for several years he was the frugal traveler and hopped from continent to continent and around the world on a budget. Give us a call if you have a question for Matt at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. Now, Matt, before our break, we were talking about you getting sick in Vietnam, and you said, I eat everything. Do you have any rules in terms of where you eat or will not eat, in terms of, you know, do you even look at how sanitary a place looks, or is that all?
Sure. I mean, okay. There's been plenty of places I've been to where I look at the way things are being served, the way things are being handled, and I keep looking.
Yeah.
You know, I like street food. There's some good rules of thumb with street food. You look for the place that's busy, so you know that the food is being made fresh and not sitting around for hours and hours. That's a good way to pick a street food place. People will say don't eat, you know, fresh, uncooked vegetables and fruit. And that's a good rule of thumb if you don't want to get sick. But, you know, then you're avoiding fresh fruits and vegetables, which are delicious. My feeling has always been the food should be worth whatever happens afterwards. And I've eaten so many delicious things that I don't care about getting sick.
Okay. Now, Matt, your first big trip that we've discussed a bit when you went to Vietnam, this was kind of before the internet really blew up, so to speak. So how much has the internet changed how you travel, how you connect, how you do things?
Oh, I mean, it's changed it completely. When I went to Vietnam, this was 1996, there was the internet, but there wasn't that much on it, certainly not for travelers. But I mean, now, I mean, I book all my flights on the internet. I keep everything cataloged on the internet. I reach out to friends of friends of friends through Facebook and through Twitter. Everything is different on the internet. The one challenge, though, is that there's so much information there about what you can do and where you can go and what kind of experiences you can have, that I worry that some of the mystery and the explorer feeling has been squeezed out of travel. You can learn so much that why should you even go? Or if you go, you're just sort of executing a pre-programmed routine.
You're following somebody else's route. Does that feel...
Yeah, following everybody's route. So I try to limit how much research I do.
Let's take a call. We have Mike, who is calling in from Hopewell, New Jersey. Hi, Mike. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How you doing? Matt, I think you'd be interested in this. When I was a young man, from 1965 to 1966, during the Vietnam War, of all things, I hitchhiked clear across Europe, excuse me, to Vietnam, to Saigon.
Wow.
And the reason for me heading, I got as far as Istanbul, Turkey, and I was totally broke. And I standing in the middle of Turkey and Istanbul, I said, well, what's the sense of going back to Europe? I might as well keep going. I had met a Marine lieutenant who had come back from Vietnam, and I drive heavy equipment as for a living. He says, if you can get yourself to Saigon, they'll hire you with no problem. I mean, you'll have a job. So,
wow.
I went forward with no money. And another thing, Matt, I went all through India. I hitchhiked across Iran, Afghanistan, and into India. I got as far as the Pakistani and Indian border, and they turned me back because of one of the kitchen wars. So I had to go back to Kabul. In the meantime, I had made some money shooting pool, of all things. You know, staying at YMCA, and I forget where it was. I made like $30 in a flight from Kabul, Afghanistan, into Amritsar, India, was $30. So I just had enough to get out of Afghanistan.
When's your book coming out? I want to read this.
Yeah. Mike, it sounds like you should write your own book. And at the time when you were doing this, this kind of travel was very unusual, wasn't it, Mike? I mean,
well,
you must...
not really. I'm 73 years old now. Mm-hmm. I did it when I was 25. And, you know, I had some experience because I had been in the Navy for 4 years, and I was driving a truck cross-country for a living, and I just woke up one morning and said, I feel like going to Europe, and I went to Europe, and I started, had a little work I started out in Bad Hersfeld, Germany, working in a factory, which I hated. It was like freezing cold, and of course I left there and went to London, and I got a job at a moving company for a couple of weeks. That's just the way I went. And then hitchhiked down to southern Spain. You know, Matt, I'm sure you're familiar with Malaga and Torremolinos and all those areas. But the thing that really got me going real well was when, as far as Bangkok, Thailand, when I finally made Bangkok, I got in a little trouble in Bangkok and they put me in jail. So,
right.
and the American embassy came down to get me out. It wasn't drugs or anything. In fact, if you remember that era, it was the hippie era. The one thing I did and made it very successful for me is I always stayed clean shaven. You'd meet all these hippie types traveling through India. I always stayed clean shaven.
All right, Mike, let me stop you there, and I'll ask our assistant, Emily, to book you for another show. But thank you so much for joining, for calling and for sharing your adventures. And Matt, it seems like Mike is what you would probably call a fellow traveler. What are the qualities? You meet a lot of people like that who've traveled, who've been places. Are you kind of a clan, a group that recognizes each other?
Yeah, this is, I love hearing stories like that because this is how my friends and I kind of live. We just sort of do these things. And we understand that there's this great joy in just heading out into the world and seeing what happens. We don't necessarily need checklists of sites to see or itineraries to follow or travel agents to help us get around. We can do this on our own. We're independent in a way. I love that. I'm so inspired by these tales of the 60s and even people doing that today. It's the most wonderful thing.
And Matt, what is the difference? Is that the main difference between a traveler, quote, and a tourist? Because I felt sometimes talking to travelers, they not maybe look down on tourists, but they make sure that everybody knows that they are not a tourist. So what is that difference?
They look down on tourists.
Okay. I was trying to be nice.
This distinction, right, between the tourists who are sort of on tour buses and following tour guides and staying in generic hotels and eating at touristy restaurants, and travelers who go and do it on their own and have these off-the-beaten-path experiences. And travelers definitely look down on tourists as being a lesser form of life. And I've seen a lot of that. I've probably participated in that a bit. But in recent years, I've definitely changed my mind about it. There's nothing wrong with being a tourist. People have difficult lives. You work all the time, and you get a chance for a vacation. And who am I to say that you should do it my particular way of roughing it and exploring and going off the beaten path? It's totally fine to have a vacation where you relax and you put yourself in someone else's hand and you just can relax that way. I like to do that once in a while myself. Maybe not with the tour buses, but a vacation is a wonderful thing, and we've all earned it by
right.
But living our day-to-day lives in America.
It also seems like there has been a lot of effort in the tourism industry to create experiences that are more like travel. And that's also something I think that's being very much helped by the internet, that you can be a tourist, but you can, the experience is more that of a traveler, where you go off the beaten path because you can read about it on the internet and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a balance to be had in all of these. I mean, even the most hardcore travelers are going to enjoy, a nice comfortable bed every once in a while and a good meal.
Yeah.
There's no all or nothing.
Let's take another call. We have Helena joining us from Wilmington. Hi, Helena. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I have a daughter who's going to be spending about 4 months in India, in Jaipur, starting in August. And I was wondering, what advice does your guest wish he would have gotten in order to maximize his good experience with India before he went there for the first time? And I'll take my answer offline.
Thank you, Helena. So
that's a good question. India, I love India. I've been there a few times. I've spent, several weeks or at least more than a month there, all over the country. India is a wonderful place, but you must be very patient. I've found that it's a place that can't be rushed. Getting from place to place takes longer than you'd think. You can't sort of impose your will on the way things are done there. I remember sending a package home from Pondicherry, which is on the sort of southeast coast, and it required a trip to three different places. I was sending a bunch of textiles and clothes home, and I had to first find a place that would box the clothes up, and then a place that would put a stamp on it, and then I could finally take it to the post office where it could be mailed. And it was like, it seemed crazy to me that there were these three separate systems for mailing a box in India. But that's the way it was done. There was nothing I could do about it except to let things unfold as they would, and be patient about it and accept that this is the world, and I'm here to see it, not to make it the way I would like it to be. So the college advisor daughter, simply be patient.
Good advice.
And let India do its work on its own terms.
All right, let's take another call. We have Marjorie on the line. Let's see. I can't see where you are calling from, Marjorie. Are you there? Or do we have Matt? All right.
Well, I'm still here.
Yeah, I know, but I think there was another Matt who had called in. We'll go back to that in a second. Okay, so India was one of the places where you had to learn patience. Is that something that I'm sure you need in many other countries as well, just to kind of have that sense of, all right, I'm going to accept this day for what it is?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is the definite philosophical approach to travel is I'm going to go and see what's out there, and I'm not going to rush it. I'm not going to try and do 15 different things in one day. My usual approach is, if I can get three things done in one day when I'm traveling, then that is fantastic. That is amazing. And if I can get four things done, that's better than I could ever believe it's possible. Yeah, I like to take it slow. I like to give myself a lot of free time so that I can meet the people that I wind up meeting, so that I can have the spontaneous, serendipitous adventures and encounters that make travel exciting for me. I want to have good memories of travel, not great photos of travel.
Let's try one more time if we can get Marjorie to join us from Elkins Park. Marjorie, are you there?
Hello. I'm there.
Okay, great.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Go ahead. You're okay. On Radio Times.
I traveled to Indonesia, actually to Bali first, in 89, 90, I think in like July. And we were living in Australia at the time in Sydney, and we took a vacation to Bali. And from there, we traveled to Java. And when staying in Bali, when you ordered Balinese coffee, it was always really cloyingly sweet. And I'm a black coffee person. And by the time we made it to Java, we were at someone's house, a friend of a friend's house, and my friend couldn't translate very well, and I asked if they could make me some black coffee, and everybody gave me a weird look. And I was like, please, I can't stand how sweet it is. So they made me black coffee, and here I am, an American girl sitting in somebody's living room, you know, people who are being very gracious and generous, and I take a sip of it, and I'm ready to spit it out across the room, because they export all the good coffee. They only have, like, gravel coffee that they serve. It was pretty weird.
Thank you so much, Marjorie, for sharing that experience. And Matt, I'm wondering, how much has all this travel changed your palate? You know, sometimes you start out hating the sweet coffee, and then after about 2 weeks of it, suddenly you're like, this sweet coffee is pretty darn good. So how have you
definitely
changed?
I mean, especially traveling around countries that are tea countries more than coffee countries, I've gotten really accustomed to those Nestle 3-in-1 packets of instant coffee, instant creamer, instant sugar. You know, I developed a kind of liking for those things.
Right.
Which is a really kind of bizarre thing to like, I think. But yeah, I mean, my palate is pretty broad now. I kind of like everything. That was another one of my philosophical shifts when I was a kid. I decided that it wasn't up to the food to change according to my palate. I had to learn to appreciate foods for what they were. And when I made that shift in thinking, all of a sudden I could kind of like everything.
And how do you eat at home when you're not traveling?
Well, my wife is from Taiwan, so I tend to make a lot of Taiwanese food, a lot of Sichuan food from the southwestern China, the very, very spicy food. But, it's summer in the northeast right now, and there's amazing fruits and vegetables in the farmers markets. I just cook a lot of very simple, fresh food as well. My day job right now is as the editor of BonAppetit.com, so I am thinking about food all the time.
It's a tough
it's
job.
It's very random. I mean, my diet is, there's no one thing. It's all over the place. I mean, this Sunday, I'm barbecuing a whole lamb.
All right. What time?
I don't even know what to say about that, but... That is the random food life of a travel writer.
Do you experience sudden cravings where you think back to a trip and you think, oh, I wish I could have, I don't know, the horse meat sashimi? Or are there
all
those moments?
All the time. Okay. All the time. Yeah. Oh, I mean, from traveling around Japan, there's the horse meat sashimi, which is just incredibly clean flavored, so smooth tasting, wonderful stuff. The sushi, the ramen there. I did a trip for the Times where I ate 4 bowls of ramen a day for a week in Tokyo. Everything I've ever eaten everywhere makes me want to eat it again. Thank you for provoking such hunger.
Yeah, I'm getting pretty hungry myself. And you're a father now, Matt, right?
Yeah, I have two kids. I have two daughters, Sasha, who's about 4.5, and Sandy, who will be 9 months pretty soon.
Okay, so what do they eat? Not the baby, but... Do they eat like you?
We try. Sasha, the older one, is rejecting vegetables these days, as 4.5-year-olds often do. But she's pretty good about food, I think, in some cases. There's a wonderful Taiwanese dish called just stewed meat. It's ground pork cooked with soy sauce and 5-spice powder. And it's wonderful mixed in with rice and classic Taiwanese food, and she loves it. She'll eat it all the time. So that's a kind of nice thing. Mm-hmm. She loves a Vietnamese dish, which is thin cold rice noodles with grilled pork and vegetables and herbs. And she'll eat that, which is fantastic. But still, she's 4.5. Getting her to try new things is tricky.
Mm-hmm. And have you taken your kids traveling extensively yet, or not quite?
Oh, boy, yeah. Sasha was 6 weeks old when my wife and I took her to Italy for 2 weeks. It was a frugal traveler story, frugal family. We went to Venice and Milan for a couple of weeks. Sasha has a very well-stamped passport. She's been to Italy a couple of times. She's been to Taiwan 4 times. Germany, California, all over the place. Sandy, however, is almost 9 months old, and she's never been on a plane, so she's horribly deprived. But I'm sure pretty soon we'll be taking her around.
And we have just
vacation season.
Yeah, we've just a few seconds before we go to break. But is traveling, so you find traveling still doable as now a family guy?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It should not stop anyone from traveling. Do it when they're really young. That's the key.
All right, we're talking with Matt Gross. He is a travel writer and has written The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World. We'll get back to his world travels. And Matt, I also want to talk more about your times at the New York Times and what you did for them and how that all came about. So if you have a question, we'll get to it at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. We have a couple of callers that we'll get to right after our break. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
The Wistar Institute supports WHYY. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. Melanoma is the deadliest skin cancer, taking the life of one person every hour in America. You can protect yourself this summer by using sunscreen and limiting your time in the sun. Scientists at Wistar's Melanoma Research Center are committed to understanding the causes and developing effective treatment for melanoma and better ways to prevent it. The Wistar Institute. Today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures. Online at wistar.org.
Jury selection in the federal racketeering trial of the legendary Boston criminal Whitey Bulger begins next week. Bulger was wanted for 19 murders when he was captured in 2011 after 16 years on the lam. Bulger was also an informant and got protection from the FBI. On the next Fresh Air, two journalists who've covered his story join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. is Iraq on the verge of civil war? Dozens of people have been killed in the deadliest violence in 5 years. Also, the discovery of genetically modified wheat in a field in Oregon is prompting fears about U.S. exports. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowane. We're talking with Matt Gross. His new book is The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World. Matt is a travel writer and has been to at least 60 countries all over the world. And Matt, before our break, we talked a bit about you're now a father of two, married, and we talked a bit about traveling with kids, and we have a question along those lines. Let's get Matt, the other Matt, on the line. Hi, Matt. You're on Radio Times.
Perfect segue. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So, traveled all over, lived overseas. This kind of what you guys have been talking about is basically my life, you know, 10 years ago. Now, having a child, he's been on a plane plenty of times. How do you marry the two, you know, having travel, having adventures, but having to pay attention to nap times and still seeing the sights, but still staying in safe locations and safe environments?
Well, you slow down. You don't try and cover a ton of ground. You don't try and be constantly on the move. You find an apartment, probably on Airbnb.com, which is a fine way to find places to stay all over the world. And you settle down. You explore single places in more depth. And it gives you a different kind of travel experience. It lets you be experimental, but sort of rooted. So instead of, you know, biking from, you know, Saigon to Hanoi or something like that, you wind up getting a house. You wind up getting a life. You imagine yourself having a daily routine somewhere. That's the way to do it.
Okay, Matt, thank you so much for your call. And Matt Gross, let me ask you, you just mentioned Airbnb. Can you describe what exactly that resource is and how
you can use it?
Sure.
Airbnb is a way of renting people's homes, apartments, futons, floors all over the world. It's sort of like, you know, there's all those listings on Craigslist that are sort of sketchy. This is an organized and reliable and refundable layer that goes on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of, it's fantastic. It's very traveler oriented too. It's not just Joe Schmo and his little apartment for rent. It's people who understand that connections between people are important in travel as well as having a place to stay.
And this is worldwide, or where can you find places on this site?
Oh, yeah. I think they're active in 192 countries.
All right.
So, yeah.
Let me get Amy in on the conversation, because I think she had a question about that kind of site as well. Amy, you're on Radio Times. Hello.
Hi. I'm a world traveler, too. I've traveled to India, the Middle East, the Palestinian territories, Eastern Europe. And I didn't really have a question. I just wanted to add, you talking about the Internet and how it's changed dramatically. There's a website called Couchsurfing, which I'm sure you've heard of. And I just feel like it's added so much more value to my traveling, because it's a hospitality program where you can stay with people's houses. You don't pay them, but you can pay in other ways. For example, you can bring gifts, or you can take them out for meals. And if you don't feel comfortable sleeping in their homes, there's also kind of social groups. For example, like in Dubai and the United Arab Emirates, they have social groups, and they'll go out, they'll meet for coffee, or they'll go out and they'll take tours and things like that. So I just wanted to add that to the conversation. I wondered, Matt, if you had ever gone through couchsurfing. I'm sure you've heard of it, though.
Thank you, Amy.
I love Couchsurfing. Couchsurfing is a wonderful website, a wonderful community of people who get travel. These are people who open up their homes to you for free, giving you a place to stay, or just friendship. There's plenty of Couchsurfers who just want to meet for coffee or a drink, who want to show you around their towns. And again, this is a network with, I think, 3 million members now all around the world. It's great in big cities. It's a great way to meet people in far-flung villages that you might not otherwise go to. But if you have a friend there, hey, I'll go to this little random town in Kyrgyzstan just because there's a cool couch surfer there that I can meet.
And yeah. Matt, let me ask you, obviously the internet now helps you a lot to connect with people and to find fellow travelers, but you do a lot of that without the internet. Kind of when you're traveling, you run into others and you say, hey, where are you going? How do you know whether you've made a good connection? These are kind of serendipitous, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, most of the time I think it works. I always try to get people to approach me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually sort of a shy person in some ways. I feel uncomfortable going up to strangers and saying, hello, I'm Matt. Would you like to be my friend? that makes me feel a little uncomfortable, but I like to put myself in positions and present myself to the world in an open way so that people are curious about me and come up and talk to me. And I figure that the kind of person who's going to do that, on a sidewalk in Slovakia or somewhere in New Mexico, is going to be the kind of person that I want to meet.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of outgoing, curious person who wants to help out a stranger.
Had you ever had connections that were not so good? I recall Cassidy from your book, or who was fine, but...
Yeah, there was a guy one of the islands off British Columbia in Canada who was sort of a fascinating character. I met him out in the woods with his dog and seemed to know his way around. His name was Cassidy Buchanan. And he was a fascinating companion for a long time. He knew where these little Indian caves were. He could tell me which berries were safe to eat. But what I didn't quite realize when we were wandering around this island together was that he was incredibly drunk and, like, getting drunker and had this sort of nasty argumentative streak that emerged the more he drank. So that was maybe not a great connection. But I'm still very happy that we had that connection, mm-hmm. that I met him and that we shared some hours of exploration together. I'm not upset. Friendships on the road can be short-term,
yeah.
And you don't have to hold them. You know, not every friend that you meet on the road has to be your best friend for life. It can be your best friend for a couple of hours, and then you go your separate way, and that's good enough.
Mm. Now, I've mentioned several times the New York Times, and of course you wrote the Frugal Traveler column for several years. How did that come about?
Another
lucky streak.
Yeah, I talked about lucky streak. I've been working at sort of low-level editorial jobs in New York for several years after coming back from Vietnam. Nothing very exciting, but nothing terrible either. And I got bored. I wanted to go back to writing novels. So I saved up some money, and I flew off to Cambodia and Vietnam, where I was going to research a novel about 1950s Cambodia. Before I left, though, through a friend, I'd gotten in touch with an editor at the New York Times, and I emailed her and said, hey, I'm going off to Vietnam and Cambodia for a while. Is there anything I can look into for you for the travel section? Anything you're curious about? Not asking for an assignment, just, hey, I'm in the neighborhood. I can see if there's a story here. And she wrote back right away and said, no, thanks. Don't worry about it. Have a great trip. Good luck with your novel. So, okay, fine. I was still going to Southeast Asia anyway, and I was out there, and after about 6 weeks of doing research and bopping around, I got another email from that editor, and she said, hey, we're looking for Vietnam and Cambodia stuff. What do you got? And I pitched her three stories, and she said, oh, good. Write them. It was the happiest day of my life, getting an assignment for the New York Times, and also the most terrifying day of my life, because all of a sudden I had to write these stories really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I wrote them well enough, because they asked me to do more, and they asked me to do more, and then they asked me to take over the Frugal Traveler column. It had started in the early 90s, being written by a woman named Susan Spano, and then by Dayzan McLean, and then it was opened, and they asked me to do it. I got an email from my editor saying, hey, how'd you like to take over the Frugal Traveler column by doing a 90-day trip around the world and blogging your way? And I said, well, sure, I got nothing planned.
Why did you eventually decide to leave that position?
Well, I was writing a lot as a Frugal Traveler. I felt like I was sort of writing the same thing. My travel philosophy had crystallized. I liked the idea of not minding so much the discomforts that come from traveling on a lower budget. I'd written about couch surfing. I'd written about Airbnb. I'd written about a million different things again and again, and I felt like I wasn't doing anything new. And I wasn't enjoying it the same way. It was a wonderful opportunity to have been given, and I didn't want to be the bitter old travel writer who is disgusted.
Still on a budget.
He's doing.
All right.
I'd step aside and let someone else do it.
Let's hear from Tom. He's joining us from Reston in Virginia. Hi, Tom. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. I just want, this is an observation, not a question, but I just wanted to point out that during my own travels, I have observed that cultural connections between rather disparate countries. I worked for a couple of years in the Republic of Georgia. And I used to shop in the local markets, and they have terrific bread there, and they're made in sort of an upended stone barrel. And the bread is kneaded and then thrown, and there's a fire in the bottom of the barrel, and the bread is kneaded and then thrown against the side, and you end up with a wonderful bread. And it's cooked that way. And sometime later, I traveled to India, and sure enough, they made bread the same way. Now, there are claims by Georgians that thousands of years ago, some Georgians immigrated and went to India, and resulting in a specific caste of Indians. So I don't know whether that's true or not, but certainly is the bread is made exactly the same way in these two countries, and they're thousands of miles apart,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, it's almost like a Hansel and Gretel trail that people have left all over the world where you can see foods emerge and reemerge.
Yeah.
Matt, I'm sure
yeah.
that's something you see a lot.
Yeah, my favorite version of that is I was in Galicia in northwestern Spain in 2006, and I ate the best octopus I had ever eaten in my life there. And I found out that it had come not from the Spanish coast, but from Morocco. So, okay, that's fascinating. The Galicians are using Moroccan octopus in their dishes. Fine. Wonderful. 2.5 years later, I was in Osaka, Japan, looking for takoyaki, which are these breaded nuggets of octopus that are slathered with mayonnaise and sweet sauces and are a wonderful little snack. And I found this great little shop that had been open for 30 or 40 years, run by the son of the man who'd founded it. And it was just beautiful, delicious takoyaki. And I was talking to the owner, and it turned out that he, too, used Moroccan octopus.
Hmm.
So halfway across the world, everybody wants to cook Moroccan octopus. And now I realize I need to go to Morocco and find out what kind of octopus they use.
So a question for you, do you also see a new kind of brand of food tourism emerging where people, you went to Vietnam because you like the food, so you were maybe one of the first food tourists, but I see people talking constantly online about the food they ate and the food they want to eat and where they're going to go to eat it. So is that becoming one of the primary goals of traveling, is to eat?
Oh yeah, it's huge. I mean, this is, you've got to eat 3 times a day. You
yep.
might as well go somewhere where you're going to really enjoy it. Yeah, it's huge. I mean, food tourism is kind of the big aspect of tourism these days. And countries that have good food are the lucky ones. They're going to get a lot of tourists.
So where do you want to go next? Another question I received via Twitter was from a person to say, what are some great places that need to be explored that we haven't talked about so much?
Well, I think we talked about some of them. I mean, we'll go to Vietnam at any time. But Argentina is a wonderful place as well. People are outgoing. There's life happening in the streets. There's great food. When I go to a place like Argentina, I feel like I'm cheating in a way because I don't have to do anything to all of a sudden have a great time. Just go to Buenos Aires, sit in the middle of a square, and just watch life unfold around me. People will talk to you. Things will happen. It feels like a violation of the laws of physics because I'm expending no energy and yet having great enjoyment in return. And Argentina is a big country. It's more than just Buenos Aires. It's the Andes, it's the South, it's the Plains, it's the Pampas. Argentina needs to be explored more. Previous caller had mentioned the Republic of Georgia. That is a wonderful, beautiful place, full of some of the most friendly people I've ever met. I was walking down a street in the capital, Tbilisi, and people just came over to talk to me and invited me out for drinks without my having done anything. Everybody should go to the Republic of Georgia and eat the great food and meet the very nice people.
Now, what do you recommend people do if they are venturing somewhere where maybe the political situation we can't be quite sure about? I was reading how you left your passport at some point at a border, I think, entering Myanmar, and my heart just stopped because I thought, no, don't leave the passport. So what should you do before you go, and what should you be aware of so you're not just naive and getting yourself into big trouble potentially?
Well, I think read the news when I'm going to a new country. When I know where I'm going, I set up a Google News alert so that I get a daily dispatch of everything that's going on in that place sent to me. And I keep up. I read what the AP says and what the Times says and what all these different news sources say so that I have a good sense of what it may really be like. You can do other things, reaching out to not you know, the U.S. Embassy or the U.S. consulate, but reaching out to local people, finding contacts, finding people who are friends of friends who will help take care of you and monitor you and let you know what it's really like. The U.S. government, the State Department, is very proactive and conservative in issuing travel warnings for places. Sometimes it's justified, and other times it's a little too conservative for my case. The world is in some ways very dangerous, but in other ways, the world is full of people who want to be your friend and take care of you and make you feel at home in their country. And I think if you approach the world that way, that's more likely to happen than that you'll, you know, get robbed or worse.
And just about 10 seconds left, what's next for you? Are you content in putting down your roots and staying put for a moment?
Yeah, I'm enjoying having a job and living in New York and not going places the way I used to, 3 to 6 months on the road a year. I have some weddings to go to in California and Seattle and New Orleans, and I'm going to make the most of those trips and try and relax a little.
Wedding travel. All right, Matt Gross, thank you so much for joining us. He has written The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World, and I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I loved it.
All right, great. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Bilder, with help from Emily Bryant. Our engineer has been Kevin Griffin. Joyce Lieberman is radio engineering supervisor here at WHYY. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and I want to thank you so much for listening.